The numbers out there about chances of success for startups, you know, shows that it's unlikely to succeed. So I think for me, courage is about having your own convictions and going with it, even though you know you might fail. And I've learned that quite late in life, I think.
Welcome to Brave New Girl Podcast. I'm Lou Hamilton and I'm an artist, author and founder of the podcast guesting agency Brave New Girl Media. If you're interested in the health and well-being of people and the planet, then you're in the right place. My guests are change makers, focused on doing their bit towards the greater good and showing us that even taking small actions in the right direction, we can have a big impact on the world we live in. So, all aboard the mothership. Let's do this together. My guest this week is Laura Harnett, founder of the B Corp certified business, The Seep Company, who are replacing plastic household essentials like sponges and cloths to make them well-branded, effective, compostable, and genuinely sustainable. Circularity is at the heart of Seep, where they design everything with the end of life of the product in mind, and they're on a mission to stop 1 billion plastic cleaning tools from going to landfill by 2030. Welcome, Laura, to Brave New Girl Podcast. Hi, Laura. How are you?
I'm really, really good, Lou. Very happy to be here with you.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this because this is something that's actually very close to my heart. It's not cleaning liquids and those kind of products that you do. It's actually the tools of the house cleaning trade. But I do really care about this because with my cleaning liquids, even though I use ecological products, I can still smell what feels like it's really toxic. It doesn't make me feel good. And then when you start trying to find those kind of products or making your own, you're then still using all of these tools that are kind of plastic derived. And it does make me wonder what we did in the olden days before we had plastic things to use. So tell me about Seep and what you're doing and how you're revolutionizing the household product and tool trade.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much for having me on. I didn't think, you know, a few years ago I would be, you know, on a podcast talking about my sort of journey as a founder. I never saw myself as a founder. And the story is a kind of fairly typical one, I think. I was doing my weekly shop in my local supermarket. I had various challenger brands in my trolley, Dorset cereals, Method sprays, Tony's Chocolony, Proper Corn, all those lovely brands that have fantastic products, but are also better for the environment. They're sort of mission-driven brands. So my whole trolley was full of it. I went down the cleaning aisle, I grabbed some Method spray, and then, you know, I'd run out of sponges. And so I looked at the aisle and, you know, lots of very traditional brands like Spontex, Vileda, lots of own label, you know, and there was nothing for me to really choose for my, you know, that appealed to me. So it was all made of plastic. It was wrapped in plastic. They looked ugly and I was prepared to spend a little bit more for something else. And there was nothing there. And so I sat on the idea for a couple of years, thinking there's no way I can be a founder, it's far too risky, I'm quite like having a salary at the end of each month. And then lockdown happened. I'd just left my job in Selfridges and I just thought, you know, if I don't do this and someone else does this, I may end up just regretting it forever, and I just don't really want to live a life full of regrets. So yeah, and so Seep is all about offering people plastic-free alternatives in that cleaning accessories aisle that work brilliantly, but also they look great, because I think a lot of the products, you know, those kind of green topped scourer sponges look awful next to your sink. So yeah, that's what we're on a mission to do.
I want to delve deeper into what they're actually made of and how you came to sort of actually build the brand and make these products and source the materials and kind of help with the circular economy. But first of all, I mean, you say that you'd never thought of being an entrepreneur or a founder. So what kind of young girl were you? Are there any clues into that girl that would kind of indicate that you would be a good founder, a successful founder?
Yeah, so as a young girl, I'd say I was very conscientious. I kind of, you know, did what I was asked. I was quite competitive, especially at school. I just wanted to do the best I possibly could. I went to a state school. I grew up in South Wales, and you know, I did what everyone expected me to do, which was to go straight from university into a job and slowly kind of trudged up the career ladder. You know, I didn't really have any entrepreneurial family. They all worked for sort of local government and teachers and that sort of thing. But I really was fascinated. I remember as a child doing, you know, we had various schemes to in the neighbourhood, and I always wanted to do, you know, charge people for coming into a garden that we'd made. And so there were some clues. And I think the thing is probably, I was curious. I love the learning process, and I was finding corporate big jobs more and more repetitive. And so I think it was a sort of, you know, it's a curiosity as well as a drive, really, that has, you know, led me unexpectedly to come and do this and take more risks in life. You know, I think, you know, that's been a big thing as well.
So you said you left just before the pandemic, and you also had your own challenge in your own life. And so I don't know whether those two were linked, but very often we find that founders and entrepreneurs are kind of stopped in their tracks and kind of manage to get through that somehow, but then you come out of that with a much more driven and a sense of purpose and trying to find more meaning in life. And so what was that for you?
So for me, it was a very real moment. So I was at Selfridges, you know, which is one of the, you know, it's officially the best department store in the world. It's an amazing place to work. I had two young kids, full on job, and I was diagnosed with breast cancer. And you know, it's the sort of moment that every woman dreads, you know, it's finding a lump in the shower. You know, you go straight into what feels like a very kind of, it's like a project management, you know, you've got a laid out path that you have to follow with all your treatment. And, you know, actually it had so many silver linings. You know, it meant that I spent a bit of time with my children because I'd always been a sort of full-time working mum. It just made me sort of slow down and think about what I wanted from life. And it coincided with a moment when my husband of the sort of financial responsibility for the family. And, you know, I started getting involved in things like angel investing in a very small way. So it opened up that world of startups, which I always felt like would be incredibly exciting. But, I was probably too old to, you know, I'm in my early 40s, and I always felt that it was a sort of game for young people. So all of that came together, and I read this amazing article. It's a Harvard Business Review article, which talked about, like, yes, the older you get, and actually in your 40s and 50s, you're most likely to be successful because of your, you know, you've got a bit of capital, you've got a network, you've got some wisdom, hopefully. And so all of those, I think it was a mix of all of those, but definitely that sort of, you know, the moment to pause, you know, get through all the treatment and then come out the other side and think, what do I want to do with the second half of my career? It was a key, big moment.
And it's very exciting to have that thought and to think about how you can change the world with, in your case, household products. It's quite another to actually start that. So how did you go from the thought to the action?
Yeah, so the thought... It's you know, so it just kept niggling. I just kept on remembering that moment when I stood there in the supermarket going, why has no one else done it? I then waited to see if another founder would come up with the idea and send me a pitch deck as an angel and I'd invest in it, and nothing came. I also just had this ridiculous thing that held me back, which was, you know, I've had a, you know, relatively successful corporate career. I'm in Selfridges. How can I possibly walk into a room and tell people I sell sponges for a living? And it's just such a silly, you know, now I think about it, it's such a silly thing because most people are just excited about you, you know, about your business, finding out more. But I had this mental thing that it, you know, corporate career defined me. And then lockdown happened and I just thought, I'm never going to have a moment like this again. I called one of my best friends, Jean, who I really trust. She's a very experienced kind of financial director and operations director. And I said, she was sitting in Norfolk with her dogs in the middle of lockdown. And I said, can you just help me and guide, you know, I'm going to set myself 3 months. I'm going to do all of the sort of background analysis to understand why no one else has done this, what the costs are, you know, how much money I need to get this off the ground. And then if it all looks good in 3 months, I'm going to put my first order in. And I just set myself, you know, a timeline. And, you know, I think it's what I, you know, sort of recommend to other people who have been thinking about it for a while. It really worked for me.
Why was there nothing else on the market? Why wasn't anyone else doing it?
So there are some. So if you go to your local refill store, and there are these wonderful places, you know, refill stores and independent stores, there are a few brands that have been around for a while. They, you know, they're made of great, you know, they're made of very natural materials. They work fairly well, but I think they're relatively expensive, and what they are very eco. And so they look very eco, you know, they're very rough. And I just think the future of sustainable products and is to look great, to look like it's not a sort of compromise. And so that was my view, is that, look, we can make something that looks better, hopefully that works as well as a normal product, but that looks fantastic on the shelf and next to your sink.
I bought some skincare products and they arrived in loofahs, you know, those things that you scrub your body with. And I thought, because there were three there, and I was like, well, I can use one for my body, but maybe I can use the others for cleaning my pans or cleaning my bathroom. And they were great, but they weren't that great, and they kind of disintegrated pretty quickly. So what materials do you use? What do they look like? Where do you source the materials? Are you buying them in as is, or did you have to kind of start from scratch?
Yes, we had to start from scratch. So what I wanted to do, so the first thing I did was to figure out, well, what are people using in this category? What are they most frequently replenishing? And let's go create that list, and then I'm going to start at the top. And at the top of that list was the green topped sponge scourers that are so, you know, hiding behind everyone's loo and sink and looking all sort of curled up. And yes, you're absolutely right. So in these eco stores, you can buy the raw loofah, often cut into sections and sometimes a little rope to hang them up. But actually what people want is a scratchy side and a spongy side, which replicates that sponge scourer. And so we looked quite far, you know, so in the UK and in Europe to say, right, how can we find, so the spongy bit at the bottom, it does actually exist. So you can create cellulose sponge, which is made from wood pulp typically. So that already existed. It's just not very widely found. It's found in some places. So that already existed. And then the challenge was, well, what do you attach to the top of it to make the scratchy bit? There are some in the market that have a scratchy bit that looks eco. It's kind of brown, but actually it's mostly polyester, that which is plastic. And so there are some in the market, and so we just didn't want any kind of plastic in it at all. We found a way of kind of having the loofah attached to the sponge, to the spongy bit on the bottom. You can't stick it because glue isn't really compostable. It's not a great material to use. Compostable glue dissolves in water, and so you have to actually stitch one to the other. And you have to do two lots of stitching, because you can imagine you're stitching into a sponge, which is super, you know, it's got lots of holes and is very porous and is the worst thing to stitch. So we had a lot of, you know, we had a lot of disasters in the first stages. But that's, you know, we found a factory. We really looked to find a factory in Europe, but loofah is grown in two main countries, Egypt and China, really, in any volume. And China has the best quality, and we found the best factories there. So we're working with some people that have vetted the factories and audit everything. And because there's quite a lot of labour involved, that was the right place to do it, which is contentious with some of our very green customers. But we just believe in being super transparent about where and why we manufacture there.
You're on a mission to become a completely circular by 2030. What does that actually mean?
I mean, I think it's the way of the future, right? So we have a household waste problem, we have a plastic problem. You know, producing things with recycled plastic isn't really solving anything. There's this fantastic book called Cradle to Cradle that was written, you know, decades ago now, and it's all about, instead of designing products that are cradle to grave, you know, so have go through a linear process, you know, you make the product, you use it, you might reuse it or recycle it once, but it still goes to the grave. How do you create products that are meant to be endlessly reused? And so, you know, composting is a really good way that it goes back into the ground and nourishes the ground. And then, you know, it's a sort of circular system. So that's where we really want to be. So a lot of our products, so we have just talked about the sponge scour, but we've got, you know, gloves that come from Sri Lanka. We've got cloths that come from Europe. We've got bin liners from Europe as well. And the way that we always think about our products when we source them is, how is someone, what does someone do at the end of life of this product? Is it going to be thrown in the bin, in which case we're not really helping? Or is there a way that they can compost it themselves? Because I think there's been lots of, it's very contentious all about composting. So is it definitely compostable at home? And so that's what we do. Every product we evaluate, and it's super difficult with lots of products because the materials just aren't ready yet for that. You know, there's lots of research going on, but sometimes they're just not ready for commercial use. And then the second thing is, I think particularly in the UK, our waste management streams are just so awful. So, you know, lots of customers say, well, what do I do in my local council? And unfortunately, every local council has their own methods, and that just makes it very difficult for brands like ours, but also for customers to do the right thing. So that's the mission, is can everyone do something with it that means that it doesn't have to go to landfill? That's probably the easiest way of describing it.
You have managed to get your B Corp certification, which is absolutely brilliant, and congratulations on that, because it's really hard to get. What were the biggest challenges, and what were your biggest sort of barriers for getting your certification?
Yeah, I mean, I was a huge fan of B Corp before I set up SEEP. You know, I used to look for the logo on packages. That for me meant that a brand was walking the talk. And for those that don't know, like, B Corp is not just environmental, but it's social, it's paying minimum wage, you know, living wage. It's a whole raft of things. And so it means that you can't greenwash. Well, you know, I guess some people might argue that, but it's much more difficult to greenwash if you're a B Corp. And so I knew that as soon as I set up SEEP, I literally applied for it straight away. You know, as we were building up our processes and our policies, it's much easier to do that around a sort of existing framework that's the best in the world. So that's why we went for it straight away. I think the hardest thing, honestly, was just the time. You know, so we did it really early in our journey. We're a very small team. We're still a fairly small team, and just creating time when there are so many other things to do around sales and product development, to spend on, you know, making sure you've got policies for things, finding evidence for the impact of your product, the carbon footprint, you know, getting proper certifications in place. I think that was the biggest challenge for us. I think, yeah. And it will be going forward, because you have to recertify every few years.
With the supply chain of elements of your products, how hard is that to kind of see all the way back to the source?
It's super difficult. So, you know, for B Corp, what we had to do was to make sure there was a really strong system in place with all of our factories. We work with about 10 different factories, you know, make sure that there's documentation for every aspect of B Corp. So where are they sourcing things from? Is there a certificate to prove that, both for packaging as well as the core product? How are they paying their employees? You know, what are their ethics? Have you chosen a factory that has strong ethics, that's been independently audited as well? When you're a small business and you're trying to move at pace, all of that slows you down. But we had to be bulletproof with things like that. So, so we've worked with all of our suppliers to get that kind of information in place, which makes us a lot more confident in not just the B Corp, but much further afield. So we launched with Oxfam last year, and they have a really, really stringent process to list, you know, and so that it just gives us the confidence to be able to do that.
I've just come off listening to a podcast called Leading, and they were interviewing Kate Raworth, the author of Donut Economics. And I wonder how, with your business, are you building that in? You're obviously a regenerative leader and a forward-looking pioneer in this space. It feels relatively new, although she wrote her book in, 2017. So how do you work with those kind of ideas?
So that book is on my list for the summer, so I haven't yet read it, but I think what she talks about is, yes, how do you give back, you know, so instead of growth just for the well-being of the business, then how do you give back more broadly to society? And I think B Corp and the idea behind B Corp is very much that as well. So, you know, in each of the pillars, you've got, you know, so one of them is community. And the way we think about community is we have this thing which is about beyond cleaning. So we don't just want to sell people cleaning accessories. We'd love to give people the knowledge, share what we know, share other brands that are doing amazing things in our space, tips, you know, put amazing campaigns and petitions on people's radars. And, you know, so we see it as our duty, if we've got this amazing customer base, to share what we know and help them as well. So, you know, community would be one. We're in the process of reviewing our charity partners and understanding how we can, so our products already have a lower carbon footprint than the traditional competitive, you know, traditional products. We're trying to bring that down. We offset the rest with not just a sort of cheap carbon setting business, but with an amazing charity who actually go for quite expensive schemes, but they're run by local communities. They support local livelihoods and they support biodiversity. And so, you know, we try and do the right thing. It's you know, it's not always easy. It makes you really, especially when you're a growing business, we're not yet profitable like many young businesses. But every aspect, you know, we have people who want to intern with us, who are happy not to be paid. That's just not something that we can agree to do. You know, I believe if you bring someone on, they should be paid. And so it always raises challenges. I hope that answers the question. But it's, you know, it's at every stage that we try and figure out what the best thing is to do.
She talks about being able to thrive while working with the planet, as opposed to this massive growth in consumerism that works very much against the planet. And the pushback on this podcast was, well, you know, you're never going to convince the politicians. It's just not something that they're going to sell to the public. But I think that people like you doing businesses like yours are actually proving from the ground up that there is a will and a need and an ability to create this kind of groundswell of movement in the right direction. So how do you feel, you know, both from your perspective, but also from other businesses that you would kind of align your values with?
Yeah, I mean, I fundamentally believe that we all need to, you know, that's how businesses should be run. You know, there's this big sort of movement around better business. Mary Portis is doing that as well, that we have a responsibility as business owners to grow in a way that doesn't compromise people or planet. I do think, you know, it's really difficult to do. Like, our products are premium priced. You know, we're in the middle of a cost of living crisis. It is more expensive many times, you know, often, to buy into these products. And I think until that is the case, it makes it very difficult. So, you know, for us to continue to grow, to become mainstream, to drive real change, our products need to get cheaper and more affordable and more comparable with the other products that are out there, because it's very hard to ask someone who's struggling to pay for their food bills each week to then save the planet and buy a sponge, you know, a sponge scourer that's 30% more expensive. So, you know, I think we all have a duty to do that, and we have a duty to figure out how to make these things more affordable. And I think there's a role for from government around funding grants. You know, we've been lucky enough to get some of these grants, you know, and so that there's a healthy ecosystem all working on the same thing, which is around making it the obvious choice and more affordable for people to do that.
Some businesses are sort of building in a kind of circular system for the products themselves. So they can kind of fix them, or they can build in and kind of use offcuts. Or so is there any way that you can see that you can do that, that can then maybe offer some kind of cheaper option?
Yes. I mean, so our products just don't, you know, they're not designed. So they are designed to last longer. So ours, roughly all the analysis we've done shows that they last about four times longer than the kind of, you know, the plastic ones that start to look awful and people chuck them away. I don't think people will ever really send their sponges back. What I want is for people to have access to local composting. And there's lots of kind of local organisations now that pick up people's garden waste where the council aren't picking it up. So that is the dream. It goes back into the earth and then you don't need to repair them. You know, that we find materials. So instead of having to stitch a piece of loofah onto a piece, you know, which is just inherently expensive, we find something that is made from waste materials that can be used instead of the loofah and then can be applied in a, you know, to just fundamentally change the sort of unit economics of that product. That's the dream. I think it applies less to our, because it's kind of consumables. My mission is to make sure that they have a waste stream that goes in and that is as circular as possible.
There's a lot of technology that's happening in creating new products with kind of old ideas. And, you know, one that comes to mind is mycelium, which is mushrooms, growing mushrooms. Are there things, you know, in the future that you could see that you could actually grow your products from natural materials?
I'd absolutely love that. Yes. So we've just done some work funded by Innovate UK to look at kind of the future of the cleaning aisle, the cleaning aid aisle. That's what the retailers often call it, cleaning aids, you know, cleaning tools. And there are lots of lovely product ideas. The thing that's holding us back is the materials to make them out of, especially if you're thinking with that kind of circular mindset. So, you know, we've looked at, you know, there's a mycelium, there's Shell Works, which is made of shell. You know, there are some really amazing things you can do with viscose. So that's the next thing we're really working on, is looking at cloths and how do you recreate the microfiber cloth, which I don't know if you have one at home. I certainly have one at home from before. You know, it's made of, it's a microfiber cloth. It's made from polyester, which is plastic. It releases microplastics. We've been trying to crack how do you do that without using polyester. And there are some amazing things happening in the space of viscose. The challenge for us is a lot of that is fairly expensive, and so it's going to make sense for fashion and probably fairly high-end fashion first before, you know, I'm probably fairly low down in the pecking order. You know, it's cleaning accessories that, you know, don't command the kind of pricing that fashion does. But what I'm hoping is that we can start to understand the offcuts. You know, what about the bits that can't be used into garments, and can we reuse some of those? So that's where we're headed with it. But it requires a lot of time and patience. Which as a startup we don't always have lots of.
And do you have anything else in your dreamscape?
Yes. Yes, I do. I don't know whether I should say it, because then I might give all my trade secrets away, but I'm going to, because lots of our customers ask. So do you know, there's something called the Dishmatic washing up brush. It's a sort of plastics brush. It's a brilliant, it's the last bit of innovation, I think, in this category. And it's a plastic tube. You fill it with washing up liquid and you change the sort of plastic sponge at the bottom and you throw them out and replace them. So there could be a lovely circularity in, you replace the end bits, so you're not throwing the whole thing away each time. And so I would really love to recreate that. We again have tried really hard to find out how do you attach that bit without the plastic that lasts as long, and it's really tricky. We're not there yet, and the answer is likely to be a combination of new materials as well as some clever design and potentially some compromise around the use of, you know, so the handle actually, if you use recycled plastic for something like that, it will last 10 years. That's what plastic's designed for, and it's the best use of it. So actually, do we have to... So it's making us really evaluate a lot of the materials we use. That's my dream.
With creating a brand, being a pioneer, building something from scratch, really having these innovative ideas and bringing them into life, it takes a lot of courage. How do you define courage?
My version of courage is being happy to take a risk when you don't know the outcome. And most people in their daily lives, I think, don't have to really do that. And I'd never had to do it really before setting up a business. You know, setting up a business, not knowing if it's going to succeed, putting your savings and people who you love, you know, they've helped me fund this, putting some of their money at risk and being really confident with the idea. But actually, you know, the numbers out there about chances of success for startups, you know, shows that it's unlikely to succeed. So I think for me, courage is about having your own convictions and going with it, even though you know you might fail. And I've learned that quite late in life, I think, and got comfortable with it.
Thank you so much, Laura, for making it easier for us to make small conscious changes in our homes so that we're part of the solution and not part of the pollution. Thank you so much. Brilliant work. Keep going. We're championing you all the way.
Thank you so much for having me, Lou. It's been fabulous speaking with you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Thanks, Laura, for helping us to replace all the harmful plastics in our household products with sustainable, regenerative and compostable options. Let's feed our soil, not our landfill. You can find out more about Laura's work on www.theseepcompany.com and follow her on LinkedIn at Laura Harnett. Thank you, Brave New Girl Media, for producing and sourcing the guests for the show, and to you for listening. I hope today's story inspires you to step into the spotlight and show how you too are positively impacting the world. Take care, choose courage, and see you next time.